STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello there, folks. I'm Melinda the Enforcer. I'm here with Amy Hall, the apologetic chicks from Stand to Reason.
How does Greg keep from singing along to that theme song?
What are the words?
I don't know.
That theme song, years and years ago when Greg started on KBRT, it was just a cart of studio music. But since then, we found out that it actually is by I can't think of his name right now. We'd have to look it up. But it actually, the person who wrote it and I guess just gave it as studio music later recorded it on his own CD. And it turns out he was a Christian. It was just called Fast Jazz with the radio station music. So Greg's away this week. He is probably going to be back next week. So Brett and Alan were busy and they've been filling in a lot lately. So Amy and I stepped into the studio here. So we're going to be taking your calls in a little bit on this hour and next hour. Amy has some comments that we'll get to. But first, we're going to talk to a friend of ours. A few weeks ago, when Amy and I co-hosted the program, a caller called in and asked, "Is there white privilege?" And my first response was to ask him what he meant by that phrase before we answered it. But even after he clarified that, I was still dissatisfied with my answer afterwards because I don't think it was nuanced at all. Hold on a second. We have to fix the jack on Amy's headphones. I don't know what's going on.
It's okay.
Okay. So I just didn't think the answer was nuanced at all and didn't take into account privileges that exist that aren't built into the law, but are just, you know, leftovers or part of our society. So I asked a friend of ours to join us today to answer that question because he's a careful thinker. I trust him. He's a fair-minded person, and he's African-American, so he can give us his firsthand insight. Keith Plummer is a professor at Cairn University in Langhorne, Pennsylvania. He has a PhD from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He's been a pastor, and he now teaches on pastoral ministry and care, and also apologetics, hermeneutics, and theology. So thanks for joining us, Keith.
Thank you for having me. And we've got I've got a bad connection, so I just want you to know off the front end.
Okay.
I'm not hearing all of you. I don't know how I'm coming through. But good to talk with you and Amy. Hi.
Hi, Keith. So, go ahead.
It's really good to talk to you, Keith, because I've only ever interacted with you on Twitter.
I know.
And email.
I know. We have yet. I think we might have interacted on Facebook some, maybe. But, hopefully at ETS we will finally get to meet. I hope so.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, because you're going to that this year.
Yes.
Right?
Good.
So, and I think that's how we got to know you, Keith, isn't it? Through ETS? Is that how you met Greg first?
No, actually, it was when I was in Wheeling, uh-huh. Illinois. I was charged with putting together an apologetics conference. And so I just did some searching, got a hold of you. I did not know Stand to Reason at the time. This was like maybe the early, mid-90s.
Yeah, long time.
And Greg came to our church and did a conference, and it just so happened that the area in which our church is located is where he went to, I think, middle school.
Yeah, he grew up there in the Chicago area. Yeah.
Yeah, and one of his former teachers also happened to be in our church. So,
oh, really?
I took him on a little tour of the neighborhood, and he was saying, "Oh, that's where Mrs. Smith lived," and that's where, you know, he was like a kid. It was fun being with him.
Well, and then we see you at ETS now and then, and
we
prayed for your family when you were moving from Wheeling to Philadelphia and couldn't sell your house.
Thank you very much. Yes, we're all together now, and that feels good.
Yep. So let's get into this. You know, I mean, I think it's a touchy issue because you don't want to misstep. but sometimes it's easy to misstep without even realizing it. So last year when there was a lot of news about racial issues, you posted a few things on Facebook that I read, and I really appreciated what you posted because it helped me see that there are experiences that African Americans have that I wouldn't experience, or things that you might see that I wouldn't necessarily see. And, you know, sometimes when some of these things are said, we don't necessarily trust the source because it's highly politicized and highly emotional. And it's easier to hear it from someone like you who we trust and who we know is a careful thinker. So setting aside income and economic differences, law and order situations, all other things being equal between a black person and a white person, there are still matters of race that result in different experiences, right? Can you tell us a little bit? Just give us your perspective on that.
I use something that actually C.S. Lewis used in a different context to frame this discussion. In his introduction to Athanasius's On the Incarnation, he has that line that many people know about how it's valuable. The value of reading old books is that saints from the past, it's not that they didn't have blind spots, they just had different blind spots from our own, and therefore there was a benefit to us because they saw some things that we didn't see, and we see some things that they perhaps didn't see. And I think that what Lewis is talking about chronologically, in terms of avoiding what he calls chronological snobbery, is also beneficial cross ethnically and culturally, because I think some of the same phenomena, kind of in your question, is the assumption that, you know, there are blind spots collectively, corporately, and I think that one of the necessities of doing theology as the body of Christ globally is to have that kind of cross-cultural, cross-ethnic exchange, because there are going to be different aspects of the truth that certain groups may be sensitized to on the basis of their experience that others aren't. And so collectively, we get more of a full orb picture. And as I was, you know, thinking through some of those issues of race and some of the conflict that was going on, one of the things that I think that I noticed is that black, by and large, because of our history in the country and so forth, tend to see things in terms of patterns, where I think the majority culture is more prone to see things in isolated cases.
That's interesting.
And the way that I put it is that there's a tendency for blacks to see forests. There's a tendency for whites to focus on trees. And I think, you know, that it's not necessarily the case that either is better. But what happens is, and I think what you saw is, that sometimes it takes more for someone who has seen certain patterns to say, well, okay, let's focus on this particular tree. And sometimes it takes more for those who are accustomed to focusing on a particular tree to ever see that, well, there might be a forest here. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think that explains a lot, actually.
And I think the same thing happens when we think about sin. One of the things that I think we need to be mindful of is that we're prone to think of sin in highly individualistic terms, and the idea of sin maybe having some kind of structural effect is foreign to, I think, a lot of minds, particularly foreign to, you know, many whites. And so I think that you go back to the civil rights movement, and you see that the civil rights leaders like Dr. King and others they're preaching from the prophets because the prophets are dealing with the societal aspects of sin. And I think, so this is a gross generalization, I think you probably would find that in white evangelical churches during that time, there was more of an emphasis on the individual and personal biases without necessarily seeing issues on a systemic basis.
Yeah, so if we're looking at it from very different perspectives, we're gonna diagnose the problem. We're gonna understand particular instances very differently, aren't we?
Right. And neither one of them. I mean, I think both of them are reductionistic, biblically speaking.
Keith, I guess got a message here that you're sounding kind of muffled. We're gonna actually call you back.
So okay.
So we'll go to a break, and then we'll call you back during the break, and we'll just come back here and pick up the conversation right where we left off. And I'd like you to follow up on the comment you just made about their reductionistic, biblically speaking, okay?
Okay.
Okay, talk to
Thanks.
You in another minute or two. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, so I'm Melinda the Enforcer here with Amy Hall. We're sitting in for Greg Kokel this week. We're talking with Keith Plummer. We're going to come back to him after the break. So we'll be back in a couple minutes.
I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using five words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end: God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is, thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org. And it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's mentoring letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
This is Stand to Reason. I'm Melinda the Enforcer, and I'm here with Amy Hall. We're sitting in for Greg Kokel doing the podcast this week. He'll be back next week. And we're following up on a call we got a few weeks ago when Amy and I hosted on whether there's white privilege. And I was dissatisfied with my answer to that and just could have been more nuanced to it. So we asked our friend Keith Plummer to join us today to give us some perspective from his vantage point as an African American. And so, Keith, are you there?
Yep, I am.
So, before we went to break, you mentioned that whites seem to see things as more like individual incidents, and blacks will see things as more of a pattern. And you were saying, biblically speaking, that that's reductionistic. So, why don't you explain that?
Yeah, what I was saying was reductionistic is the idea of thinking of sin solely in terms of individual,
discrete, individual acts, yeah,
or seeing it solely in terms of systems, that emphasizes systemic aspects of evil and injustice, but not dealing with individuals. And one of the things that really concerns me about that is, and this is not a book that deals with racism per se, but it is a book that deals with the issues of justice. I really, really would heartily recommend Tim Keller's Generous Justice,
mm-hmm.
How the Grace of God Makes Us Just. It's basically a theology of, you know, what justice is, and he deals with issues of both systemic and personal sin and how that can lead to issues of injustice on many levels. But one of the things that I appreciate about his work is he talks about how it is that neither a progressive nor a conservative political ideology fully encompasses a biblical view, that both may see some aspects clearly, but there are things that are left out. And I'm particularly concerned because I think that Christians need to really be discerning of evaluating even those political parties and ideologies that we have a lot in common with, but when it becomes equated with a biblical view, then there is some difficulty. So as this relates to this issue, I mean, if you watch certain commentators, there's going to be a great emphasis on how this is a land of opportunity and everyone, if they work hard enough, can make it. Very, very dismissive of any kind of idea of implicit bias or what we're going to be talking about in terms of any reality to a phenomenon such as white privilege. And then when Christians kind of, that's their primary diet, then that becomes, that might blind them to certain things that really biblically are there, but that becomes the primary lens through which they're seeing things, and it's only one perspective.
That's really helpful. So you wrote an article for the Gospel Coalition 5 years ago when Trayvon Martin was killed, and it was about seeking the truth in various perspectives. And you mentioned in the article that you wish you'd seen more response from Christian media about that. And mm-hmm. as someone from an organization that publishes a blog, and we very often will respond to stories that are going on in the media, it's easy to fall into a certain perspective based on our own experiences. And then it can just seem like such a minefield to weigh in on news items like that without adding much insight or understanding to a superheated topic. So what did, in that story, what did you wish you'd heard from Christian media?
I think initially I was, in my own mind, honestly, I thought, okay, this is another instance of the taking of the life of a young black male unjustifiably. And I think that I was desirous of seeing that expressed. And then, as I say in the article, that there was more information that started coming in and things kept on going back and forth. Now, looking back, I think early on, still what I would have liked to have seen was just acknowledgement of something that was of national significance and of great grief to, obviously, his family, but to, there was much lament and, in many respects, anger in the black community. And I do think that it would be too much to ask Christian media to weigh in terms of a verdict. But sometimes it can seem as though there is just an ignoring when there is great grief related to issues of race. And in saying that, I'm not imputing malice,
mm-hmm.
but because I think sometimes what happens is in the same case that when people think they're doing service to someone who has lost someone, so they're not going to talk about them, or they don't want to feel the discomfort of perhaps setting them off, where we just won't say anything. And it comes off oftentimes as, well, people just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, above all, I would have liked to have seen just an acknowledgement of it, maybe prayer for the family who has lost this son, prayer for justice to be found and, you know, sought, and just an acknowledgement of the tragedy that it was. And I think sometimes, perhaps, people feel that, well, if you express any sense of lament with those who are grieving, you're necessarily making a judgment, or you're condoning what you might think might have actually been something that had instigated. And I don't think mm-hmm. that needs to be the case.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that is a concern. I know last year, when there were some, you know, racial incidents in the news with the police, and then the police officers in Dallas were shot, I know at a staff meeting one day, we sort of weighed back and forth whether we should say, you know, say something, and then exactly what would we say. And this is, for instance, when you, and I mean, you never post about race. So when you posted these things, and they were other people's posts that you were sharing, which I knew were your experiences too, I knew this was significant that you were sharing these things. But it mm-hmm. also, so as we just, you know, that's really helpful what you just said, that just a desire for justice, a sorrow over unnecessary loss of life. Because as we'd sort of discuss, what could we say, there's all these different sides and facts keep coming mm-hmm. out. And so, yeah, maybe we considered saying too much, where sometimes we can just keep it very simple.
And I know that it's difficult, and I don't mean to suggest that, you know, Stand to Reason or any other Christian media has to comment on everything that happens,
right?
Because that's just unreasonable.
But
all, I was speaking collectively.
But, right. Well, and always silence could look like we just don't care.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. So just recognition. So I remember last summer I visited when a lot of this was happening. I visited a church in my neighborhood. It's actually Greg's brother's church, and he has a very multiracial and quite a integrated kind of congregation. And I just really he just pretty much did what you just said. He just acknowledged this, and he said, let's just come alongside our brothers and sisters who are mourning right now, who feel this more personally, and just understand that, you know. And he didn't comment on any specifics or anything, and I just appreciated kind of that pastoral approach. Mm-hmm. We don't always, I think maybe here at Stand to Reason, we always think we have to, you know, come in left-brained with the facts and analysis and stuff, where sometimes we can just come in more, you know, with just compassion.
Yeah.
So we got the question a few weeks ago, is there white privilege? So how would you define that phrase, and how would you answer it?
Well, I listened several times to the podcast, and I I did have sympathy for you both as you were dealing with that.
It was like the first time we've done the podcast and somebody comes in with like the hardest question ever.
Before I would answer, and I would say this. I'll answer. I would say that white privilege refers to certain societal advantages that, generally speaking, the majority culture has that minority cultures do not. And that is not to speak of white privilege, I do not think, is to deny the fact that anyone succeeded on account of hard work, intelligence, so forth. And it's not to take away from anyone that. And neither do I think it necessarily has to be used to bludgeon. And at one point, one of the things that I noticed that I wanted to ask Amy about. Amy, you said something about to beat people down by saying they have white privilege doesn't help. And I would agree that if things are being used in terms of, like I said, a bludgeon, that doesn't help. But I was curious as to whether or not it's possible to acknowledge, for someone to acknowledge a phenomenon such as white privilege, certain societal advantages that just the majority culture has they might not even think about, without necessarily beating people down.
I was just going to say,
so if I say that I think there is something called white privilege, is that necessarily I don't intend it to beat white people down, and neither do I intend it to instill white guilt or anything like that. It's more of just kind of like an observation of a sociological phenomena that I think, at least in many respects, can be confirmed. Does it have to be beating down?
I was thinking in terms of stories I hear from universities where they have meetings and then they tell white people they can't speak because they have white privilege and things like that, where mm-hmm. they use that to then say, and now we're going to keep you from talking because we have to make up for the fact that you have this advantage. I think that's kind of what I was, that kind of thing is what I was thinking of, where people will use this concept to try and stop people from speaking or trying to make them feel guilty and that sort of thing. So,
okay. Yeah, I can see that in terms of if it is used as a silencer.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very fair to say you want to help people to see what their advantages are. So how can knowledge of that, like how can we use that knowledge to move forward in a way that's just?
Well, I think, and I don't know to whom to credit this. I think it might be, I'll just say is that the thought is not original to me, and unfortunately I can't think of who said it. But I heard someone say that when we become knowledgeable of privileges that we have, not only with respect to ethnicity and race, but in other capacities, then it becomes a matter of stewardship. If that makes sense. So,
how would stewardship play out in that kind of?
Well, if I realize that I do have certain privileges, then I think that I become more responsible upon that knowledge in terms of how I utilize that in ways that are beneficial to others, as opposed to just reaping the benefits for myself. I'm not speaking in terms of like communism or anything like that. I'm just saying I recognize, hey, you know what? Providentially, in whatever capacity God has situated me in this, and I become responsible for how I make use of this.
So do you have anything specific in mind for of ways we could steward that? Or, and I'm actually interested in hearing your description of what the privileges are and how we can use them the way you say.
Well, let me give you some examples that I was thinking about. I don't know if in the news, I think it was in 2015, I've got a New York Times article. Do you know what Airbnb is?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Were you aware of some of the discrimination issues that came up with Airbnb?
No, the only thing I heard about Airbnb, I think last year, is when they started requiring not just the homeowners, but also the people who are booking rooms there to basically sign like some ethical code that basically said not to discriminate against homosexuality and transgender and all that kind of stuff. So that's all I've really heard about them.
Okay.
which we, well, the three of us, I think, would agree is
working paper
is
that
not
three
appropriate
Harvard
to ask people.
Did we're this is from the New York Times. Just read this one thing, this one section here. A working paper by three Harvard researchers found widespread discrimination by hosts against people with black-sounding names seeking rentals. A fictional guest set up by the researchers with names like Lakeisha or Rashid were roughly 16% less likely to be accepted than identical guests with names like Brent or Kristen. And there have been numerous studies that have shown that identical resumes submitted to workplaces have been accepted at a higher rate with names that were thought to be less likely African-American. So things like that, I would say, are all aspects of white privilege that people don't even recognize that they have. But it is a societal advantage that others don't have.
I'm just curious about some of these studies. I'm not challenging them in the least. I'm just curious also, in those studies, was there any breakdown of region of the country or urban versus rural or anything like that? I'm just curious if, because I've grown up in Los Angeles, which is very multiracial, you know, not to say that there aren't separations and problems there at all, but I just am curious if there's any other kind of nuances to where that happens.
I, as far as I know, they were identical resumes. You're not saying resumes from different places, but where this was done?
Yeah, right. I'm just curious. It's probably irrelevant. I'm just curious.
I could send you this article. I think it is. The researchers sent housing requests to roughly 6,400 hosts across five cities, Baltimore, Dallas, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and Washington.
So urban areas.
Renters with names that sounded African-American got a positive reply about 40% of the time compared with roughly 50% for white guests. The results are remarkably persistent, the researchers wrote. And, this is from the technology section of the New York Times, December 11, 2015. And there have been similar studies that have been done with, places of employment. That was Airbnb. And Airbnb has responded, and I know in part because this is a business, but in their response to it, they said, we recognize that bias and discrimination are significant challenges, and we welcome the opportunity to work with anyone that can help us reduce potential discrimination in the Airbnb community. So, that's the kind of thing that people are talking about when they talk about just some of the advantages. Another thing... And again, hear me. I'm not saying this. I'm not saying this with hostility.
No, we know that's why I asked you to come on.
The 2 weeks ago, someone said, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I understand that. But for the duration of my life, the fact that I am black has been something that I have not really been at liberty not to think about.
And
I think just in terms of being a majority in a majority culture, that's just an advantage of...
It's just the air we breathe, we take it for granted. It sort of strikes me that, the opposite side of white privilege is black disadvantage. And so, it seems like the examples of the resumes and the Airbnb, part of the reason we don't notice it is because it's not happening to us. It's happening to other people. And, so maybe it doesn't always feel so much like white privilege as black disadvantage, and we just, it doesn't happen to us. So we just don't notice.
Yeah.
And we're just not cognizant of the problem because we just don't see it and experience it. And that's why it's helpful, when friends like you talk about this. I remember the post you shared last year was somebody else that grew up in the town you grew up in, who was also African American, and just sharing very matter-of-factly the number of times he'd been pulled over by the police, you know. And I remember, I can't think of his name right now, but a black senator, Republican, who also talked about the same thing. It's like, well, you know, when you start hearing people like that who don't make race a big deal all the time, you have to stop and listen.
Yeah.
And see that they are dealing with things that we don't have to deal with.
Yeah. When I grew up, and I know that this is, you know, my situation, but I think you would find many African Americans who could say, yeah, this was common in my household. I remember watching the evening news, the 10 o'clock news, and we lived with my grandparents, my mom and me, and I remember if there was a crime committed, my grandmother saying something like, oh, Lord, please let it not be a black man.
Because it would be used as an example in a way. A
white
person. Because it would be used as an example against other black people in a way that it wouldn't be if it was a white person.
Yes. Now, and I think in terms of white, I mean, I don't know if anyone really would have that thought that, you know, okay, well, because there is not a sense of this collective identity that in many respects blacks live with in terms of connotations, associations, generalizations that are going to be made on the basis of particular incidents.
Right. So what can we in the church do to teach and understand that would help race relationships in the church and in the culture with other Christians, but also those without, outside the church? What can we as Christians do to help this difference of experience and actual prejudice?
Well, there are a couple of things. One of the things that I would say is I would love to see Christians resist the urge to have extended conversations about this on social media. And rather, I would like to see it happen like this, though maybe not with the audience, but in terms of using social media maybe as a platform for either telephone conversations or face-to-face meetings. Two incidents from things that I posted on Facebook led to some going back and forth between me and two friends of mine, both white men, one with whom I had gone to seminary and one a pastor in the South, who, you know, kind of challenged some of the things that I said. And so the comment thread started. And I suggested that we talk over the phone, because I would prefer just to talk rather than try to have it play out there. And in both cases, it led to conversations of a good length that were so profitable mutually. And some very candid comments and questions and answers, and I think that both of those conversations led to a fortifying of our relationship and a better understanding in both ways about some issues that, you know, had not been considered before. So that's one thing. I think that churches can do things like I participated in a panel discussion about race with multiple minorities and whites and from various backgrounds, and that was very good. I think the churches that are desirous of having their churches reflect their communities, because I do believe that when Jesus says that the unity that he prayed for is going to be a means by which the world is to know that he was sent by the Father, the love and the unity that he was talking about was a demonstrable love and unity that could not be accounted for solely on the basis of sociological factors like affinity, socioeconomic commonality, ethnic homogeneity, and so forth. It was a it's a love that crosses the bounds that the world understands and causes them to wonder. And that being the case, I think the churches that desire that, and they're in communities that are ethnically diverse, I think there has to be a commitment to reflecting that at the level of leadership. Oftentimes, you know, that is held up as an ideal, but the leadership is homogeneous, and I think that that has to be a commitment from the top down. And I would also suggest reading some materials from believers from other ethnic backgrounds. I was reading a book once by Sung Chan Ra. He is the author of The Next Evangelicalism and a second book called Many Colors. And he asked at one point, what is the last theological book that you read by a non-European author? And I think that's a good question to consider. Am I hearing voices? Am I exposing myself to voices other than what I am accustomed to? Because, as I said in the beginning, of that phenomenon of the blind spots, and there are brothers and sisters from other ethnicities that may see some things that, from my perspective, I don't see as clearly or I don't see at all, but they're still dealing with the truth of God's Word. They just have different sensitivities based on their experiences. So I'm not talking about a relativism. I'm just saying a heightened sensitivity to certain things just by virtue of what we have experienced historically, culturally, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things that I would say. There are numerous resources on the internet in terms of voices from minority Christians, and just searching some of that out. But I think that it has to really be a commitment all around to intentionally interacting with people that are not like us.
Amy, I know you belong to a church where the pastor's very committed to, mm-hmm. you know, race relationships and inclusiveness as far as that goes and reaching out. What are some things, like Keith said, it has to start with the leadership. So what are some things your pastor or the leadership at your church does to instill that value and that awareness?
I mean, he does talk about it from time to time. We have people in leadership of different races. I don't know if he's doing that intentionally. I really don't know what he's doing intentionally, but I do know that the result is a very integrated church. And it's partly because of the neighborhood I'm in. So he's mm-hmm. been very intentional in reaching out to the people in our immediate neighborhood and doing events in the neighborhood that will draw people in also. So he is very intentional about trying to draw in the neighborhood.
So, you know, Keith, as we try to engage these topics and people who have different experiences and different perspectives because of their race, so we're talking about differences in understanding, but as Christians, how can we ensure that we approach these things so that we're not actually causing more separation, but that we're actually leading to more unity in Christ?
I think about the two guys with whom I was talking. Now we had a friendship, but we had never really explored some of the things that we talked about at length at this time. And I think that there was a sense of saying, you know what, I want to ask something, I want to say something, but I don't know really how to say it, and then giving permission to say, just go ahead, because there was a trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that I think a lot of the things that we do to avoid division actually might contribute more to it than if we were to talk frankly but yet graciously about these things as opposed to trying to skirt them.
That's an interesting point.
It's hard.
And another thing is, I don't think that the vision of the New Testament is colorblindness in the sense of denying or overlooking ethnic differences. It seems that, you know, that is something that is going to persist into eternity as the people from every tongue, language, and nation are going to be worshiping Jesus. And, you know, I think sometimes people meaning well maybe over-spiritualize, and so when we say there's neither Jew nor Greek and so forth, and people say, well, we don't want to see or acknowledge ethnicity and ethnic differences. I don't think that's what Paul is getting at. I think it's we acknowledge that, yeah, we have these differences, and if someone sees me and they don't see that I am black, well, then I wonder, well, you know, how can you not? But we recognize that we have a unity in Christ. So I think some of the ways that we talk about race are not helpful because they're not biblical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have an ideal of genericism, but the truth of the matter is when you make that kind of genericism the ideal, some culture is going to be predominating. You don't have an a-cultural, a-ethnic entity. You've got some dominant culture. So those are some other thoughts.
Amy, do you have a question?
Well, I was just thinking about, because you were talking about having the conversations where you can trust and say whatever you want to say to each other. I think in order to do that, I mean, sometimes it's hard giving up knee-jerk reactions on both sides, and that's something that I think would have to happen in order for people to feel that trust. But maybe that's why the way you're talking, you're suggesting conversations amongst people you already know that you're close to, or developing those relationships so that this is possible.
Right.
And and on one hand, I think, wow, that seems so small. How is that going to get us anywhere?
But when the whole dialogue is usually dominated by people on the news who are, making this even more highly charged.
Yeah, it's just, it seems so daunting sometimes.
It is certainly gradual, but I think that's, gradual is better than nothing.
No, yeah, that's true.
What Keith, what would you like to see happen? Like, would you like just more understanding and empathy? Is there something else that you would like to see happen through these conversations, this gradual change?
I would like to, that's a good question. I would like to see, well, let me refer you to something else that I came across that I thought was really, really helpful. There's a pastor named Adrian Crawford who wrote a piece in the CT Online on Ed Stetzer's blog. And, it was in March, and he was talking about his experience as a black man who has ties and connections with both white evangelicalism and the black community, and the feeling at times that he is just like really not fully welcome in either, except and until he is speaking against the other. And I can relate to a lot of what he wrote, and I really appreciated it. But one of the things that I would like to see is And this is going to sound somewhat maybe, I don't know, you know, unrealistic, but I think it is the ideal. I would like to see us all striving to recognizing an allegiance, a loyalty, and a unity in Christ that is far greater than the allegiance and loyalty that we have to an ethnic group, a political party. And I think that there is a lot that goes into this discussion, as I said before, that really causes or should cause us to think, where do allegiances really lie? Because, you know, whether it is progressive, conservative, Democrat, Republican, black, white, a lot of the things that we, as Melinda said before, that we're willing to hear or not willing to hear is because of the source. And I think that, you know what, sometimes even the sources with which we have strong disagreements see at least some things right.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a national tendency to just screen out anything that comes from a source that we have already positioned ourselves against politically or even racially. But I'm thinking especially with all of the political stuff mm-hmm. that has been going on. And I mean, I'm not saying this in a partisan way, but this gets kind of in what we're talking about. The slogan, Make America Great Again, one of the questions that arose in my mind is, okay, what period are we talking about mm-hmm. and for whom? Because, you know, as a person of color in America, that is I think that's a real question. Like, okay, what period of America are you trying to get back to that was great, and for whom was it great? And I'm not saying that in terms of, as I said, that's not a partisan comment, but that's a question as a black man I couldn't help but ask.
Mm-hmm. So, talking about sources we may screen out and slogans.
Excuse me?
I'm just leading up to another question. So, you know, Black Lives Matter. I mean, a lot of people have responded to that by saying, well, all lives matter. But I've read and I've heard some people say, yeah, but there's a black person is going to hear that slogan differently than a white person. So is there mm-hmm. something we can learn from that slogan? Because that's pretty controversial.
Yes. Here's what I would say, because I was talking with someone who kind of raised that All Lives Matter question. And it was someone that I thought was, that I knew was, you know, very committed to the pro-life cause, a white individual. And I said, if in the defense of the unborn, you were to say pre-born lives matter, would someone be reasonable in concluding that in making that affirmation, you were somehow lessening the value of born lives? And she said, well, no. And I think what that statement was designed to communicate was not a superiority or not a diminishing of the value of anyone else's lives, but just saying these lives matter also, and they seem to be, in some situations, treated as though they did not. So when I look at that, I would say, you know, some of the provisions, and I'm not making a one-for-one correspondence here, I'm just using this as an analogy. The provisions that God made for the widow, the orphan, the sojourner, and so forth, was not because he was saying these lives matter more. It was because these lives are susceptible to being taken advantage of and mistreated by others, and so, therefore, I'm going to make these provisions to say their lives matter.
They're more vulnerable.
Right. So to come back on the knee-jerk reaction as all lives matter, I think is to seriously misunderstand the intent of that statement.
And we can acknowledge that truth without buying into everything else that some of those groups do.
You know, there is the,
like you were saying, we need to be able to listen to
the platform of the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of the official organization, but then, you know, that statement has extended beyond that. And I think that what it was designed to communicate is not superiority, but saying, you know, these lives should be treated as though they matter.
So we have 1 minute left, Keith, and you had mentioned earlier about the importance of reading other perspectives and other kinds of voices, and you mentioned specifically Tim Keller's book on justice. Are there any other people or books or sources you would recommend? It'd be helpful for others to read.
There are some websites, and I hesitate to mention some because I might leave them out. But these will link you to others. There is the Reformed African American Network, RAN, RAANetwork.org. There is Reformed Margins, which is another group of minority Christians from a Reformed tradition. That's kind of where I am, so that's where I'm coming from. In terms of some scholars to read, Anthony Bradley, Jarvis Williams at Southern has written a book about Paul and issues of race. That's some starting point to, just hearing from other voices. And I don't expect that anyone who listens to them is going to agree with them on all points. But I think that it just is a matter of first at least being willing to hear with an attitude of, okay, I want to listen as best as I can, not to formulate my defense against it, but just to hear what they're saying and what is behind what they're saying.
To listen and consider.
Well,
yeah. Keith, I really appreciate you coming on and spending this time with us and having a helpful conversation and giving us your perspective. It's been helpful. So thank you very much.
Well, I am glad, and I just want to say I am so grateful to Stand to Reason. I'm so grateful for the friendship that we have had over the years, and I do appreciate and commend you for being willing to go into this territory, and I hope that this was in some way profitable.
It really was.
I love you guys.
And love you too.
Thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you very much. That's it for this hour, folks. Tune in to Stand to Reason, str.org. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.